Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Tarzan Williams.
I don't understand what that has to do with the movie, but hey.
I mean, I could always add the soundbite.
No.
We have been away for the holidays, but we are back to round out this year with a few extra episodes before the start of 2023, and that begins...
How is it that time already? I feel like we barely started this year.
It does. I was just telling someone the other day, it feels like it was just January, so it looks like it's going to be January again. Also with us is intern slash part-timer slash stenographer slash coffee bringer brings no coffee slash I need to be nicer to slash I probably won't slash ensign Amy.
I swear there gets more slashes every single week.
Yeah,
that's the only way it works.
But people, I don't like slashers.
It's how you put people in their place. We got a great show in store
I'm
for
sorry,
you.
I'm sorry, what?
As we're going to be talking about the recently released Fox Searchlight picture film, The Menu. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Spencer, give them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlossophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlossophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlossophy101.
That's right. You can check us out on our website at filmlossophers.com, where we got allegedly over 300 episodes ready for your listening pleasure. We have everything from action, anime, comedy, to conversation about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlossophers.com. You can also find us wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire wherever you find podcasts. Look for us there, The Filmlossophers. Give us a follow, give us a subscribe, listen in. I feel like you'll like something, that you'll find something you'll like, and if you think we're worthy of it, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, we have. We'll give you social links at the end of the episode, and yeah. Before we dive into the episode, I kind of wanted to talk about, Spencer recently made a really big purchase.
Why are we talking about my poor financial decisions on the podcast?
It's not a poor financial decision.
I thought he was going to talk about your new, like, extendo arm for your mic.
No.
That's little potatoes compared to this.
Small potatoes. Little small potatoes has a theme song.
Minuscule.
Small potatoes. Yeah, it's an actual show. I'll show you later.
There's a reason why we have to turn you down. So Spencer recently took the big plunge and went and bought himself is it an OLED?
It's an OLED.
An OLED Ultra HD 75-inch?
65.
65-inch still looks like 70.
Because when you jump up to 70, it jumps up in price by like $1,000.
Either way, Spencer went and bought himself a brand new Fandangle toy.
Yes, I did.
And need I say, this thing is like having a movie theater in your own house. It's really cool, but I want to know, what were the steps prior to coming to the point where you clicked confirm on that pay? Because I know you're a very methodical person. You're very like you do think things through really, really well. I'm not saying this is a not thought through process, but I want to know what the process was, because you're also very fiscally responsible. Out of literally everybody here, and I think I can speak for all three of us, you are probably the more fiscal responsible person. Fiscally responsible, yeah. So what? Don't look at me like
I wasn't disagreeing. Okay. I have money, but also children. Therefore, my fiscal responsibilities are children.
Yeah, it's a bit easier for me because I do not have the children.
Yeah, yes. I have a computer and a TV. That's it. So tell me, what was the process for you? Because in my mind, making a purchase like this is almost like assuming, like accepting the fact that you're about to build another extension of your house. Like, I feel like it's like on in line with that, because you got to measure, you got to make sure it's the right size. You got, did you do any type of preparation before you actually bought the dang thing?
Okay, so this is not the latest model of this TV. It's the older one from last year. So I think when it came out last year, I started to see like hype about it. So like I was on that like hype train of like, oh, I'm gonna, I was like, this TV is over $2,000. I'm not buying it. That's ridiculous.
wow. I sweated a little bit there.
Yeah. So like I was just like reading around. I was like, no, this one seemed pretty cool. Like if there was ever a deal, like I might get it. So like, I like, because like I thought dimension wise it'd fit in here and like all that stuff. So flash forward to this last Black Friday. And like Amazon's like, hey, we got this TV we've been seeing you look at every couple of months.
Yeah. Big brother chimed in and said, hey, by the way, you remember this thing you saw 8 months ago? And you were like, ah, that's not going to work. Guess what will work now?
Yeah, they're like, okay, so now it's under like $1,300. And I'm like, and I've been saving for a TV.
Not saving for a home, not saving for a new car.
A TV is easier to buy than a house.
I agree.
Like, if this is a TV that costs enough towards, it's like, do I want a TV or a house?
It's like, do I want a TV or do I want to eat for the next month?
You
know, just
like, unless you can live inside that TV, it's not worth it.
I mean, the box maybe, but I'm just, you know, just
not
saying.
This one, that box was so narrow.
So you made the decision to do so. Did you have any second thoughts before you clicked the final button?
I mean, there's always second thoughts. So I was like, you know, it's Amazon. Like, the return period is like the February 1st. So I was like, that's plenty of time.
That's another thing. When you told me you bought it on Amazon, I almost like fell over, because I wouldn't trust anything over $100 to come through Amazon.
Oh, really?
Mind you, this microphone that I'm recording on is like $400, $500, and I got it through Amazon. But either way, like everything else, like it's just, it's odd to me that you would trust Amazon.
I think that's because Amazon was like, okay, so here's the deal. So
Amazon came by in 90s sitcom style. The soft piano came through. He sat on the chair backwards, like, listen, son. When you go through things.
No, so they were like, okay, we're throwing in this thing for Black Friday where people will come and install it. And I'm like, this is your moment. They're going to stay there till it turns on. You all look at it to make sure it actually turns on and works.
Yeah.
That's how it works. And I'm like, okay, that seems good. If I've got like other people, be like, yeah, that's a working TV. And then we're out of here. And so we did that, and that made me feel better about the whole thing.
So there was actual people who came through. They brought it up to your apartment. They took it into the home. They took down the other TV.
No, I took down the other TV.
Oh, okay. So you had to clean the workstation.
Yes, the workspace for them.
And then they put it on the stand, and then they plugged it in, and they turned it on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Then they all looked at it and went, this is God's work.
I would say that would have been a missed opportunity if they hadn't. Like, okay. Well, I mean, is this one of your more smaller big purchases, or you got something else in store?
Smaller big purchases.
Well, because we just talked about how it's not the same as buying a house or buying a car or whatever. Yeah. So I would assume this is on the smaller end of big purchases of that list.
I mean, I guess so, technically, yeah, because I bought a car and that was a lot more than $1,000.
What would you say if someone if someone was saying, why should I buy a TV like yours? What would you say were some of the benefits?
I didn't really realize until I got this TV, but color. Like, my last TV, I was like, oh, this is cool.
His last TV was black and white and the 6.
No, it was not. It was like
it had a booty.
It was a 4K I got from Walmart like back in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It was like $250. So I was happy with it at the time. Like, it did a goodish job.
Mm-hmm.
But upon getting this one, like, comparing the two is ridiculous. That's like if you got a first grader to like paint you an art project, and then you also got an art graduate to paint you the same thing.
So to all you kindergartners out there who are listening, this is an insult. Learn better.
Is that the Crowley moment in Good Omens? Yes, where exactly. He just sprays things and says,
grow better.
Because one of them has limp leaves and he's sun scorched. He can't help
some
that.
Some people are shy. Don't hurt him. Anyway. So
I'm confused.
So you've so far, have you seen any good movies on it? Have you played any video games? Because I know those are the two predominant things you usually do.
Yes, I've been leaning into the video games. Unsurprisingly to everyone, the Switch still looks like the Switch on this thing. So. If anything, it looks slightly worse because it's so clear that it's like you realize that some of the menus could be like a bit little like better resolution.
Yeah.
But my PC is much more 4K friendly, and I've been playing God of War on that, and I'm like, this looks amazing.
Well, it's congratulations on your adult purchase.
Thank you.
Because the first thing I said to you as soon as I saw, I was like, "Hey, your first grown up purchase or your adult purchase?" Because this is a big deal. I mean, this is a huge TV. If you ever move it, it's because you're moving out of your place.
Oh yeah,
it's not because of you know. So, Amy, grow better. Just
kidding. So mean.
I'm just kidding.
Wow. You're not David Tennant, and you don't have a squirt bottle. Don't threaten me.
I mean, I could grab one from over there. If you need to
help,
those only have soap in them. That's
that's gonna make it worse.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm gonna die.
I'm glad you got your TV, and I'm glad you're happy with it. It is actually pretty cool. And the first thing we did as soon as we came over to check it out was we were flipping through all the different movies on streaming and whatever we had on Ultra HD. So.
Yeah, like a 4K Blu-ray of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Man-verse coming, and I'm like, we're going to watch that.
I'm so excited.
Well, speaking of gourmet visual effects, let's talk as we dive into the recently dropped film out of Fox Searchlight Films. Sorry, that's a mouthful. And that is The Menu. Now, this is a movie that we have actually been talking about on the back end for a long while now because of the fact that it just looked interesting. I mean, how many times have you ever, you know, just perused through any streaming service and there's literally a myriad of like food related shows?
Yes.
So we're going to dive into this and to the message that it, you know, is trying to say and give our thoughts on it. But before we do, Spencer, give us that official synopsis goodness.
A couple, Margaret and Tyler,
Margot.
They put the T on there. Yeah, sorry. Her name's Margot.
Did she say that during the movie?
Yeah, yeah. She does.
I did not hear that.
Sorry.
Travel to a coastal island in the Pacific Northwest to eat at an exclusive restaurant, Hawthorne, where the reclusive globally celebrated chef Julian Slowick has prepared a lavish tasting menu for select special guests. It becomes increasingly apparent, however, that his elaborate menu is designed to catalyze to a shocking finale.
Directed by Mark Millad and produced by Adam McKay, Betsy Kosh, and Will Ferrell, the film actually stars Ralph Fiennes, Anya Taylor-Joy, Nicholas Holt, Hung Chow, Janet McTeer, Reed Bernie, Judith Light, and John Leguizamo. Couple key pieces of information about this movie. Screenwriter Will Tracy actually came up with the idea of the story while visiting Bergen, Norway, where he took a boat to a fancy restaurant on a nearby private island and realized that they were stuck, or trapped, however you want to see it, on the island until the meal was done. One other key piece of information, the lavish quote-unquote food layouts were prepared by renowned French chef Dominique Crenn, the only female chef in the U.S. to attain 3 Michelin stars for her restaurant, I'm going to butcher this, Atelier Crenn in San Francisco as of 2016. Though many of the cast and crew were often tempted to taste the delicacies between takes, they had to be reminded that the food items were predominantly props and thus inedible. So this the food, as much as it looked delectable, was not meant for human consumption. Also, to kind of note, I didn't really know that Will Ferrell was a producer for this film, which is kind of striking. It's kind of like when you find out, what's that guy's name? The guy from This Is the End.
Seth Rogen?
No, the other guy.
There's a couple of
The one who ends up being like the jerk, Danny McBride.
Oh, the guy that you hung out with at San Diego that you liked to talk about a whole bunch that you had pizza with, but you couldn't remember the man's name.
I've never even mentioned it on this podcast until you said it.
I mentioned it because you mentioned it to me a lot.
So anyway, you find out like Danny McBride has been a producer on like so many movies and it's crazy. A lot of like well-known actors and actresses become like almost to a point to where they've taken that back step back to behind the camera kind of thing to be able to, you know, see from the other angle of things, you know, especially when it comes to producers. So one of the things about this movie that I really do want to highlight, and we're going to get into a lot of this, is how much it kind of holds that satirical status of a film. And I don't think a lot of people know that going in. And surprisingly, unsurprisingly, it satirizes a lot of what I mentioned earlier with those food shows and the things that we've seen in like on Netflix and on Hulu and on, you know, even Disney Plus has been doing it with some of their food, with some of their shows pertaining to food. So it's interesting coming to a movie like this where you don't really expect satire, but it happens and you're like, oh, you know, kind of like going to a food tasting and finding out, oh, this is really good. It's really interesting. So we're going to dive into a lot of that and a lot of our conversation, a lot of our thoughts and opinions. There will be spoilers. So spoiler warning, obviously, this movie, once you start watching it, you definitely know where this movie's going. So, if you haven't seen it, be prepared. We are going to be talking about certain spoilers and things like that. So, you're warned. As we dive into this conversation, first thing I want to ask you guys is, what are some of your guys' experiences with like food shows or like the food community? Because this movie relies heavily on the experiences that people who are coming to watch it have had. And I feel like because of the Food Network or the, cause there's another food channel, isn't there? It's not just cooking. The cooking channel.
It's cooking.com, but that's one of them. There's things, I think Discovery has something else that they do.
The Travel Channel has some as well, because that's where
Something or Other as well does something too.
There's PBS like, has some, like obviously like with Julia Childs and all.
Hello, PBS has some.
Not to mention streaming services like Chef's Table or Ugly Delicious or, you know, the myriad of different types of food competition shows that are on nowadays. Chopped, Cutthroat Kitchen, Iron Chef, America Iron Chef in the original. I mean, there's a whole myriad of stuff. So what I want to know is where your guys' heads were at in terms of recognizing, you know, the experiences from watching a lot of these shows. Like, what does that look like?
How much food stuff do you watch, Spence?
Not really any. because I don't like the idea of watching someone cook. Like, because then I'm just hungry in my house and that seems lame. So like the only food shows I watch are the garbage ones, which are Kitchen Nightmares, because it's it's the same thing every damn episode, and I don't care.
You have a point.
And then it's also Hell's Kitchen. So
you're a Gordon Ramsay fan, huh?
I guess, because like I guess I got really into it. Okay, no, here's what, like, I watched them when they were on the air, but then I got really into it because of whoever he hired to run his YouTube channel, because that person knew how to do memes. They were all over the place, and it was amazing.
Like, a lot of them were, like, sending the food back at whatever, like, but it's like a 20-minute clip of compilation, like a compilation clip. Yeah. Yeah, I'm in that same boat. I'm a huge Gordon Ramsay fan, just for the sake of I love how he just walks into a kitchen and it's like, this is short. Just yelling at.
Okay, but have you ever seen the English Kitchen Nightmares?
Like, I've seen some of the episodes.
Like, that one is the tone between America and Britain is so wildly different that
I just know of the one what was it, Cajun cooking kitchen that he went into and he actually finished the plate.
Oh yeah.
That's one of the only few ones that I know. I know I've seen a couple of those there. But Amy, what about you?
So I grew up in a household when we finally did get cable, or satellite, whatever they wanted to call it. I would have my parents would sit down and you would have your food, because if we were sitting in front of the TV, not at the table, and someone would turn on Emeril Lagasse. And so we would be literally watching
the BAM guy.
BAM guy. We would be watching him make food on old, like old school Food Network, like when it was still really low budget. So it kind of got ingrained in me to watch food and food programming because there was a kind of comfort in it. The one thing that I'm really proud about myself is I've seen beautiful food. Most of it I've never eaten. And I will not pretend that I know how to make it or even attempt. I'm like, if I'd like to go and try some, I will, but I won't. And it's actually matured and changed over time a lot. One of the first ones I remember watching that actually kind of stuck in my brain about the way that food on film was shot was actually from like 2013 on PBS and was called The Chef's Life. It follows Vivian Howard. She's a, at the time, James Beard nominee chef in North Carolina, and it's her farm to fork, like her restaurant, and it's her working with the restaurant and the team, and it's just, it's documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, much to Eddie's chagrin, in 2015 came out I'll Have What Phil's Having, which has now been turned into Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix with Phil Rosenthal, who wrote Everybody Loves Raymond.
So
my guts.
So here's the thing.
Backstory.
Here's the thing. So I get an invite to astound film critic Leonard Maltin. He's putting on his first ever film festival, and it just happens to be during Mother's Day weekend. So I'm like, okay. You get invited by Leonard Maltin, you go to see Leonard Maltin. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go. I buy two plane tickets. I take my mom with me for Mother's Day weekend, and we go. I got us a hotel, which is literally just a stone's throw away from the actual theater. It's at the Grauman's Theater, the Egyptian Theater, for those who don't know. And so I go, and mind you, this is like 2019.
I thought it was before. That?
No, it was 2019 because it was in that transition period of everything else going
right,
on.
The before times.
So I go. I'm there. We're watching movies. Leonard Maltin is like talking to everybody. There's celebrities, like older celebrities and celebrities all over the place who are talking with Leonard, talking with his daughter, his wife. I met Leonard Maltin's wife at the front gates, and I thought she was just some random person. And come to find out, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I almost said something negative about you, but it's like, she was lovely. And so I go in and I'm looking at the list of things that I have to go, that are going to be shown. And the next day, early on Saturday morning, was supposed to be a movie essentially done by Phil about them bringing Everybody Loves Raymond to Russia. I believe it was something to that effect. It was a documentary. And he was there. And so I'm like, I don't know who this guy is. I have no clue. And I send Amy a picture of the whole venue thing, the sheet. And she goes, oh my God, Phil so-and-so is going to be there. He, you know, he's a... Huh? Phil Rosenthal. You go, Phil Rosenthal is going to be there. And this is not... You should, you know, oh, you if you can, get an autograph for me or something, whatever. I'm like, the thing starts in like 10 minutes. And I don't, so she's like, yeah, get something. So I go down there. The documentary has already started. It's already like almost done. So I'm sitting there in the foyer of the Grauman's Theater, and the doors open and everybody starts pouring out. And I see Phil, and I'm like, I think this is the guy because everybody's following him. So I go over, I'm like, hey, Phil, I'm sorry to bug you. I have a friend who's back in Sacramento who absolutely loves you. Do you mind doing a quick video? And he's like trying to look around, trying to see where his agent is or whatever, trying to beeline it for the door. He goes, okay, yeah. And so he does a video for me, and I still have it on my phone. He's like,
he goes,
hi, Amy, your friend accosted me to say hello. So, hello.
That's literally the video.
And
it's great.
And so I'm like, all right, cool. And so I send that over to Amy. Amy's like, oh my God. So
it was
whatever.
Awesome. And the word accosted, I was like, uh-oh.
So I go through the weekend and then I come back and I'm like, who the heck was that guy anyway? And she goes, oh, that's the guy from Everybody Feeds Phil. He's the guy who did my... And she starts sending me all the clips and episodes from his show. And I'm like, this guy is hilarious. This guy is amazing. why didn't you tell me any of this before? I look like an idiot walking up to him. And she goes, And I'm like, so ever since then, I'm like, I could have schmoozed this guy. I could have brought him something. I could have gone and gotten him like a pastrami sandwich or something. He's a New Yorker, probably. He'd probably appreciate that. To schmooze him over, to get him to know me, to like me, so I could, I mean, I could have been traveling right now. We could have been in between seasons and me off to Peru for whatever they eat out there. But no, Amy literally was like, yeah, it's this guy from Everybody Loves Raymond.
I'd also like who to is go that? In my defense. I had said, no. Hey, you should see the show because,
no.
Because as I'm aware, Eddie, you don't just like food. You love food. Like you I have do. A deep and abiding appreciation for food. And ever since seeing that first season of the version, it was called I'll Have What Phil's Having. But watching it, I was like, oh, I really like well-shot food. And I'm like, and it makes me, I bridge the gap between being hungry and going, I'd like to experience that. I would like to have the opportunity to eat that. Meanwhile, Mr. Cranky Pants over yonder is blaming me for not schmoozing yes, people.
Blame
for the
is
best
a great word
for
that. Because it was like, after I started watching his series, I'm like, I looked like a complete idiot and non-intelligent person to this man who could have whisked me away around the world. Like, you know, it's just one of those moments where you never really live down. But yeah, needless to say, I'm not quite over it, but I'm over it. Not really. Okay. So anyway, is there anything else you want to add through your myriad of conversational stuff that you're saying over there?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it light. The original Great British Baking Show was absolutely wonderful when they originally started on PBS because those people, even though it's a competition, they get flowers and a giant silver or a crystal platter at the end for winning. Like, there's no money. It's just for the love of baking, which is so something nice. That I found that I started
because British
seeking.
People can't have anything nice.
That's mean.
Hashtag Brexit.
But so there, and then also I have a problem that I like K-dramas, and they have a tendency because
that's
they
not
enjoy
a cooking
people
show nor what we talked
well,
about.
Well, there's a K-drama that revolves solely around food called Let's Eat, and they make some of the nicest shots of food, and I can't help it.
Okay, so
wasn't there a K-drama that was like completely in a subway or something ridiculous?
You know what? There's a lot of ridiculous K-dramas. You can't just put it out there generically.
So,
because we're not going to... Because Amy will...
I know which one he's talking about. Keep going.
Are you done?
Never.
So, moving on.
Food.
A lot of my experience with a lot of food shows, it really boils down to the first person that really made me fall in love with the idea of food preparation and the science behind it, which was Alton Brown. Alton Brown is a massive, he's a massively well-known, not just chef. I mean, because he cooks, he's not technically a chef, but he is. I mean, he does cook the food, but he also is very intelligent, where his team does a very thorough job of researching a lot of the different elements of cooking, the different styles, the different techniques, the science behind just cooking as a whole. Which, you know, for me, who was a science nerd back then when I was younger, it was like brain food. Watching like, oh, this is why, you know, meat cooks the way it does, the way the proteins break down, the way this, the way the heat, blah, blah, blah. Like, his explanation for a lot of these different things was great. So falling in love with that and then just seeing all the other stuff that came out about after that. I mean, Gordon Ramsay is a huge, what do you call it, I can get lost in just watching all of those clips on YouTube or watching the episodes, because it's like a brain turnoff type thing. Just watching them yell and demean American people in like and they're in their ability or inability to cook food or run a restaurant correctly. And then as of late, I actually just recently started getting into within the last couple of years of Bar Rescue, which is even more unique because it's more like this guy who's ran bars across the U.S. is going into these dives and kind of cleaning them up. But he's like an American version of Gordon Ramsay in terms of the way he talks to people. So it's great. And then also some of the more fun types of, you know, food stuff like Cutthroat Kitchen or Chopped. But I think the one person who really brought me back into the idea of wonderful, ugly, but delicious food was David Chang, who absolutely is the most transparent chef I've ever seen on TV, in terms of his ability to talk about food and his ability to talk about the stereotypes and everything else that goes with it. So my expertise doesn't delve into a lot of like the old guard, like Julia Childs or Emeril Lagasse or Julia's Martha stuff. Stewart. I don't.
Julia's stuff is fun to watch because she is excited. But like that was also Saturday afternoon. It was on PBS right next to Jacques Pepin. And if I could hear or understand between both of their accents, I might figure out what they're cooking.
I have no idea who Jacques Pepin is. But either way, I don't know who that
He's
is.
He's older than Wolfgang Puck.
Anyway, going back to this movie, because Spencer's already droned out. He's already playing Minesweeper on his computer.
I was looking up Bar Rescue, and I wanted to see which episode was a good one.
Ooh. You can start with the first season. The first season is like the most
clunkiest. The internet disagrees. It's season 5.
Okay.
That makes sense. Well, there you go. Because I think that's the one where they have the three or the two-tiered bar with the nightclub. And there's a lot of them where owners just keep giving away very expensive bottles of alcohol. And you're like, why?
I think that's the one that was in San Francisco, isn't it?
Yeah, there's one in San Francisco. There's one here in Sacramento, too.
Swinging back to the conversation at hand.
You handled that.
Let's go ahead and talk about first impressions. So, obviously, we all went to go see the movie in theaters, playing right now. What were your guys' thoughts immediately as soon as you left the theater? First impressions, start with Amy.
I want a cheeseburger.
Mm. Makes sense.
I want a cheeseburger.
I'm assuming you're trying to say that that was your first impression.
No, that was my first impression. So my first impression, I want a cheeseburger, was like, I am hungry and I am craving now a cheeseburger.
Spencer, maybe you can give us a more articulate response to that.
I would have died if I was in this movie in this scenario.
Thank you. That's
very quickly.
Thank you. That was much more articulate. So I appreciate many
things I would have done wrong.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. First off, I would have never gone to that island because I wouldn't have been able to afford it.
Same here.
I would have walked up to the boat, had Spencer's TV in hand, and said, "Here's my ticket. Let me in." Because that would have been the only way to get into that. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, like I don't think I've ever seen anything with Anna Taylor-Joy in it.
Yeah, Split.
I don't. Okay, let me rephrase this. I don't remember this woman's face. So every time I see her, it's like the first time I see her.
Did you see The Queen's Gambit?
No, but I remember her from the card because Netflix kept pushing it.
Yep, there we go. Okay, at least we got one.
Yeah. So, like, I could. I feel like at the end of this movie, I was like, you know, this was her own gambit in this movie, really. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, that's my pointless comment of the night. Eddie, what
first
about you?
First impressions outside the gate, I was kind of stunned. I was in like I was happy for an odd reason, for the sake of like the way this film rounded out, because it was almost ridiculous. It was like if there was one way that this movie could really stick the middle finger to like all those gatekeepers of the food community and the food shows, it was the last like 5 minutes of this movie, because the whole movie itself is a very well-written film. It's a very well-directed film, and every single instance that they could just jabbed another finger in the eye of every gatekeeper that is that tries to think that they are the authority on food or fine dining cuisine or things like that. So there's a lot to unpack with this movie, and we'll dive into some of that. But I don't know. Did you guys get a lot of the satire work that happened in this movie? In terms of it making fun of that?
I mean, yes is what I'll say, but like sometimes I during the movie, I was like, since like I'm not watching food critics as much, I'm like, I don't know if I'm missing anything. I don't think so. And I feel like after seeing the whole thing, I feel like the answer is I don't think so. But like, I especially got it when it came to Tyler's character and how he was just acting the entire night. I was like, I feel like I get exactly what this movie's going for with this person.
Because it's unfortunate that we look at this particular movie, and it's just the nature of the world today. Like, we all have people. We're in Northern California. California is just known for snobbery. So we all know somebody or know of someone who is that type of person who goes in and you guys order food and like, oh, this is good, but you've never had it the way it's supposed to be meant unless you go and have it here. Or you go to a restaurant and they're like, oh, you see, they did it like this, but there's another way that you can actually do it where it actually is like this and blah, 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 blah. And Amy's looking at me like, do I do that?
I think you've done that once or twice.
With food?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't claim to be an authority. I just claim to be like a knowledge dark hole. No, like knowledgeable dark hole.
I think because we had gone out when I had gotten my new job, we had gone out for, and I wanted to treat, so we went to one of the steak places around here, and I ordered I don't remember what cut of meat. I was like looking at it, and the waiter came by and was like, do you know what you want? And I was like, no, I don't really know about all the different the types of steaks. Like, I know which takes longer to prepare. And I said something along the lines of I was looking for like a really good beef flavor, which sounds really dumb when you talk about steak.
Especially when you're right in front of the waiter and like, excuse me, waiter, I need something that tastes like cow. Can you give me cow flavor?
I want le mou flavor. No, I said I wanted it to be really beefy, and I wanted it to be kind of unctuous. So like have that really rich, fatty kind of mouthfeel. And you go, you said, oh, well, then you don't want this cut of meat. You want this one. This one's going to be, and I don't even remember which one it was. You're like, this one's going to be a lot better. It's going to be a lot leaner. It's going to give you exactly what you want, and it's not going to fill you up too much. By the way, we also need to get this, this, and this. And I was like, oh.
I'm sorry. Was okay. I wrong in my assumptions? Was I wrong?
It was delicious, but I didn't know that that was like, so there then was why, etiquette.
Why'd you say anything?
It was just really funny.
Oh, my gosh. I'm talking about those
that
people.
It was a good celebration dinner, though. Yay for my job.
I was talking about like the people who essentially are the purveyors of ultimate experiences and come to you and like, oh, you may have done this, but you've never done it right until you've done it this way. Mm-hmm. Which there's always people like that out here. I mean, we just literally within the last week and a half, I believe, just found out that there's another restaurant here in Sacramento who was awarded a Michelin star.
It's $197 a person for a tasting course.
Yeah, and the fact is that I'm pretty sure prior to that, I don't know if it was that expensive before, but now that it has a Michelin star, it can definitely raise those prices. Yep. And people who are like, oh, you know, I went to this restaurant before it got its star, and I actually had this, you know, this, their carbonara before it got changed up because they wanted to appeal to the masses or whatever. Like, there are people actually out there like that. And mind you, the sad thing as we are talking about that is the fact that we are, Sacramento is known to be the farm to fork capital of the world. And so when we talk about it, we're also kind of like talking about ourselves. Cause,
I mean, you haven't had farm to fork till you've come to Sacramento.
Truth be told. No. So there's always, I think that's one of the things, like I've critiqued a lot of different things in terms of professionally, whether if it's video games, movies, TV shows, even plays at times. I will never get into the game of critiquing food because of the fact that it becomes a very quick, slippery slope, i.e. with what we see with the critic that's actually in the movie. So let's go ahead and dive into the movie a little bit in terms of the focus of the film, because obviously the story surrounds this world-renowned chef who is essentially putting on an experience for his diners that is par to none. And it ultimately is going to lead to the demise of everybody. in that entire room, from the attendees to all the other chefs to the main chef himself.
To the overly ecstatic sommelier who's popping by about, like, this wine is made from these very, just these berries that was grown on this side of the vineyard, and it's all one row. Like, every time he dropped by, I was like, dude, this guy is so arrived on his
and,
wine.
And you know what I was immediately thinking? This guy used to do tastings at Sonic. Like, he was the guy who, isn't that the same guy from those commercials with those two guys sitting in the car in Sonic?
He might be the guy for the soda guy that's like, yeah, this drink, this one's really good.
With That'd be amazing if this man if just is. Built his career around selling drinks to people and whatever he's eating.
There you go. There Wouldn't you surprise go. Me. I mean, he got picked up by the chef. And so we see this ultimately, you know, really unique and constantly devolving dinner escapade that is occurring. And each course is another iteration of just what the chef is trying to get across to these deserving people. According to him, the one thing he didn't account for was Anya Taylor-Joy's character, who goes by Margot in the film, was not planned to be there.
She and, was a seat filler.
Well, she was invited.
It's an award ceremony.
Yeah, like, not a seat filler. She was invited by Nicholas Holt's character, Tyler. To come to this event because he knew that they don't seat single seats, and he didn't have a date.
Which is funny because the chef's mom's there by herself.
Yeah, right. She's sitting alone by herself. And so this whole thing ensues, and the chef is like weary of pursuing the evening with Anya Taylor-Joy's character there because she's not planned to be there. She's not supposed to. And just chaos ensues. One of the key things about this movie is it's almost shot like it is one of those food specials. Mm-hmm. Like, immediately as soon as I was watching it, it looked just like how they did Chef's Table, which is on Netflix. Oddly enough, a lot of the shots did look a little similar, even the way the ingredients, the name of the dish and the ingredients were on the side of the visual. It was like, oh my gosh. This movie's like literally throwing punches at Netflix. I wonder if this is Disney's safest way to throw shade on Netflix, because this seems to be it.
I mean, it didn't even have Disney's logo in it, so there's nothing safer than that.
Exactly. We get all these great instances of conversation, different kinds of conversation, especially with, you have a failing aging actor played by John Leguizamo and his agent. You have three...
It's not his agent. Amy Carrero is his assistant. And shout out to Amy Carrero, who is making a feature-length film because she has won awards for being Adora in the new She-Ra on Netflix. So maybe she's throwing shade at Netflix, too. I don't there know. You go.
Yeah, keep she's awesome. Keep going with that logic.
She's an Amy. We also
get a table of three Chad bros who work in investment, and somehow you have this older couple who seem to frequent the restaurant quite often.
At least one of them does.
Yeah. Yeah, true. And then you have a table where there is a food critic.
And her editor.
And her editor who helped essentially.
That was her editor?
That's supposedly. Her editor, yeah.
Oh my gosh. He is such a yes man.
Yes is not even like, he's like, oh my gosh. Yes man is the nicest way to say it.
I know.
Yeah. He is, what did the chef call him? He's a, what is that when you, oh, enabler. He's an enabler. Yeah,
very true.
And then we get the table with Tyler and Marco. And it's just, it is such a trippy type of film. Because you think on one level it's going to be some type of like horror style type movie. But then it has so many different aspects to the movie. It's dramatic. It's sad. It's scary. It's funny. It's lighthearted. It's like the scene. There's a scene where they, and it's in the trailer, where the chef essentially sends all the men to go run and hide. And if they can get off the island, they can get off the island. But if they're caught, they have to come back to the restaurant. And everybody else is caught except for the editor. And when he's found, they find him in a chicken coop. And the person who finds him puts a dish in front of him with a golden egg. And it's like a creme fraiche egg. I think, I don't know. Yeah,
it's something like that where it's like, essentially it's like the consolation prize for the last person found.
Like it's like and a golden like, goose type of thing.
And you're like, what? And then he's just sitting in the chicken coop and he takes the egg and he's like sitting there with his tiny spoon to eat it. And you're like, what?
Yeah. Let's talk about the performers because I feel like there are so many to choose from in this one. Like Amy was mentioning with Amy Carrero. You know, there's so many different people to highlight. Let's start with you, Spencer. Who did you want to highlight out of this movie?
Oof. Like, literally, it would probably be easier to find someone you didn't like. Because, like, everyone... And, like, even the douchey people were great, like, in their own way.
Yeah.
I'm going to play, say... the woman who played Elsa?
Hong Chao. Yeah.
Like, she's wonderful.
I know. She was just delightful. And like, whenever someone said something there and it wasn't part of the plan, you could just like see it in her face. She's like, okay.
Absolutely. I felt like she had the funniest scene in the entire movie where there's a scene where the chef has laser printed on tortillas different elements of these people's history. And they look and like the aging actor has one of his movies on the tortillas and the couple have some pictures from their like past, including pictures of the husband doing very salacious things. And then you have the couple or you have the critic who has like an article on one of them that she had written.
But it's also pictures of all these restaurants that she had closed after she had reviewed them.
Yeah. And then you go to the Chad Bros, and it's all these bank statements from like hidden accounts in the Cayman Islands. And so they're like, what the heck is this? What is this? And they call her over like, what is this? And she goes, it's a tortilla. Deliciosa. And I'm like, oh my God. And it's like, it was such a great scene because she never broke character. Like you never really saw her break out of character for the dinner portion of the scenes. And it was so funny. And she was just so deadpanned and she nailed the performance.
Oh yeah, she was fantastic.
Yes.
Was there anyone else?
Oh, I get multiple people?
Well, since Amy's about to get the rest of the entire cast and crew. She goes, The Grip, Mr. Jonas, whatever. Or
wow, mean.
Let's see. Okay. I don't even know this guy's name. He doesn't even have a name. But he is simply titled as the boat waiter. Yeah, he was a really big twist during his scene, so I really liked how he played it.
I can concur with that. Very
true, very true. What about you, Amy?
I am going to trying to steer away from the heavy hitters because the cast is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I already brought up Amy Carrero and her delightful turn, even at the end, when they pan to her in that that last sequence, mm-hmm. there is this look of delight and exultation on her face that is just so scary, but it's so well done. I think I want to kind of highlight John Leguizamo in his he plays, ever since seeing him in Chef, like I've loved him before, but seeing him in Chef and him being around food, and then seeing him in this where he is playing an aging actor who is struggling through, like he's got to take jobs, he's trying to do something, and then he's like, you know what I'm going to do? They're going to get me, we're going to be in Italy, and it's me on a Vespa, and I drink some wine, and I'm like, it's so good. And she's just looking at him like, no, this isn't going to work. It's the juxtaposition of that relationship is so well played between the two of them. But John Leguizamo he's 100% committed. And he's so good. And the slow unraveling of the story for all of these characters is so brilliantly done. And he's just one of those ones that I was like, I didn't know what to expect because it's John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Like, you never know what you're going to get, which is the best part about being able to watch him. And this was just like, whew.
Yeah.
Okay, buddy. And then if I'm going to pick anybody else, the enabling yes man editor, which I don't know his name, everything. He was...
I think it's Paul Adelson. His name was Ted in the movie.
He was, besides being the last person to be found, good for you, he was so brilliantly, like, it was literally an eyebrow, a twit. Like, he embodied that yes, 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 yes mentality so much that it was, like, oozing from his pores. So every time they even just kind of, like, the camera panned across the dining room and you saw him in the corner, he was always leaning into the food critic. Like, he was never... His body language, the way he was blocking, the way he was portraying, it was always feeding into her. And it was just so, like, it was, okay, it's bad. You don't do that. But it was so well done that I couldn't not. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to do one more, and I'm just going to mm-hmm. say it. The female sous chef. The one female sous chef. And I'm leaving it there.
Lord so above. Can name it. Oh, my gosh, this woman. Okay. I mean, all of those performers, especially with going back to what Spencer had said about Hung Chau. Hung Chau actually has a starring role in the upcoming movie The Whale with Brendan Fraser. So after seeing this with her, I'm actually interested in seeing, because I know I've seen her in other things, but I can't for the life of me remember many of them. But I know that she is, oh yeah, because she's also in Watchmen. She's in that series.
Artemis Fowl.
She was in Artemis Fowl. She was in BoJack Horseman.
Oh, gosh.
she's also the other female lead in Downsizing with Matt Damon. Sorry. But outside of the ones that you guys mentioned, like, I feel like we've kind of overlooked, and I know purposefully, but I have to admit, Ralph Fiennes was one of those particular individuals mm-hmm. where I honestly wasn't sure how I was going to react with him, because he's doing an American accent throughout the movie. He's English. And it's one of those types of things where you know that they're not from where their accent is, so you listen for how well they can keep it. Kind of like, I guess, apparently the Italian or non-existing Italian accent that Tom Hanks put on in Pinocchio. So... Ralph Fiennes, though, after he started getting into the role and he started getting into the character, focusing on his accent, like, just completely went away. Like, my focus on it, and he was just a phenomenal performer in this movie. Like, you could actually see Ralph Fiennes be a real-life chef the way he acted in this one. Like, I don't know where he took direction or how he, you know, got inspiration, but he looked great. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Nicholas Holt. Nicholas Holt is the one friend that, or the one person that we all know or know mm-hmm. of, that just completely knows how to ruin an evening by being too serious.
Yes.
And I felt like his whole arc in this film was very interesting. I don't know how well it landed at the end of it, but I do know that the scene that you had mentioned earlier, Spencer, where the chef is like, oh, you know, Tyler, we all know who you are. You know, you talk about this and you know about this machine, you know about that. So why don't you come up and cook for us and tell? And they literally put him in the driver's chair to cook something, and he completely fails. And it's one of those instances where I, much like Lost in Translation, how you get that last scene between Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson, and there's that whisper. I'm like, I want to know what he whispered to Nicholas Holt, because I need to know. He does such a great job of completely being that person. I guess that's the best way to put it, because we all know people like that. Shows make us do things like that, or make people act as though they know the exact, you know, way on how to do things. And I feel like this movie used Nicholas Holt as kind of the cherry on top to kind of get that point across. Because like I mentioned earlier, this movie is all about satire. This movie is all about making fun of all those people who choose to become self-proclaimed, you know, gatekeepers. Essentially, it's the right word. And I don't know if a lot of people know what the term gatekeeper means. There's a lot of that within, like, the comic book community, or within certain, like, franchises, like film franchises or movie or show franchises. But a gatekeeper is somebody who feels like they are inundated with the responsibility to protect all that is holy behind the gate of that fandom. And they are the only ones who know what goes in and what goes out, and how it should be. You know, there are people who are gatekeepers of specific genres of movies. There are people who are gatekeepers of, you know, DC or Marvel. There are gatekeepers of Pokemon or, you know, Dragon Ball Z. You know, there are people who imbue themselves with the honorary glory of being the ultimate defender and last word on a certain subject. So that's what I mean when I say this movie satires the gatekeepers of this particular community, because all the way from the attendee or the person who goes to these events to the people who take advantage and don't really see the uniqueness of the meals and will buy it just because they can spend the money, or the people who critique it to the extent to where they feel like they have to make up words in order for them to describe what is going on in this meal, which is interesting, because I don't know if you remember, Spence, when we used to do sound design, or when we used to do when we used to do sound for events and churches or whatever. Do you remember when we used to have people who would come through and be like, you know, oh, you got to make the sound more creamy, or you got to make the sound more, it's got a little bit of crunch to it. You got, like, we would have people come through and they would use words like that. And I think for the fact that, and it didn't happen until afterwards, where it was like, it didn't happen until I started looking back on it that I'm like, those don't make any sense. Like, how do you make a sound more creamy? Like, what does that mean? And nowadays, there's like all these, you know, parodies of you know, sound teams and whatever who go through the stuff like that. But,
you know, I don't know if I ever mentioned this back in those days. But like, at first, you know, I did try to make it sound different. But then after a while, I was like, I'm not going to do that. So what I would do is I would just turn a few of the knobs in the empty aux channel.
Yep. That's
they don't know.
No. And they're like, oh, it sounds so much better. What'd you do? Oh, we need to save that setting. Make sure you save it. Take a picture. Use your phone. Take a picture. It's like, I just turned your gain down, dude. It's like it's the whole psychology of it all. And this movie kind of moves in all those different, you know, directions of the gatekeeping. What do you think, Amy?
Well, it's funny that you bring up gatekeeping as, like, I do see the satire and I do see the stereotypes that are being portrayed, but I didn't think that this movie was solely focused, because it's multi-layered, much like a parfait. Oh my gosh. Sorry, that Shrek joke was coming out one way or another. I didn't think it was gatekeeping. I thought it was about hunger. And this is going to follow with me here, that everybody that is shown up to that island, that is on that island, save for Margot, is starving for something. There is this insatiable hunger that they cannot fill. It's we see it with sous chef Jeremy when he talks about the pressure that he will never be able to obtain. Like, he wants Chef Slovic's, or yeah, Slovic's life. He wants the prestige. He wants all of those things, but it's something that he'll never be able to obtain. When we look at it with John Leguizamo's character, he is starving to be back where he was. The bros, I don't know, they're just empty, period. Tyler is starving for the attention and the accolades of being, like, seen, and everybody in some way, shape, or form is just
keep going. Hungry. If you're going to make this stick, you got to make it stick right. So, well, what about the bros? What about the aging couple? What about the critics?
So the aging couple, the critics, very understandable. She's the one that she had found Slovic. She was the first one that wrote it. And so it's like she needs that yes man. She needs people constantly feeding into her, because she has to be, like, self-important. She is self-important, but she feels like society owes it to her. And since she personally was invited by Slovic to this dinner, which we find out that he sent a text message, and she was like, oh, this is all for me, oh, he's doing this for me, he's being so cheeky, she's grasping at the concept that this is something personal for her. She's hungry for his attention. The aging couple, we're split between the secrets that are just hanging out there, where the husband, he's craving a lot of things and they're not all good. And the wife seems to be in this place of numbness where she's just so empty. It doesn't matter what's feeding her. You're never going to understand it. And then the bros, they're the ones I've been trying to figure out for a very long time, because they're just scum. And I'm saying that in the nicest way to say that, because they're scum. They are running. No, actually, now I figured it out. They're constantly running after the next big thing. The reason that they showed up, they're gonna expense this on the reports for the company. They're hungry for everything that comes with all the money. And then the staff themselves, like, you're dealing with Hong Chao's like hunger and desire to always be like a chef's beck and call, which becomes threatened at one point with Margot. And the literal cult-esque experience of his brigade, who are hungry to have him tell them, not only recognize them, but tell them that they are like enough. And it's just, I found it to be about hunger, and not just the, you know, gatekeepers.
What article did you read that out of?
The one where they interviewed because
I was like, this is such a short amount of time for you to come up with such an extensive answer. So well, you, to be and very you were honest, looking at your phone for a good amount of time. So I'm like, okay, she's reading something. Which
very honest, before you do that, I was trying to figure out why there was this, like, even before I read the article with Margot's character, why she's like, I'm not hungry. I'm not hungry. I'm not hungry. And Tyler is so peeved by it. And it was driving me nuts through the movie, because I was like, well, anybody who is like, oh, you put down all this money and this was a big experience, you should be eating, right? And she's just like, no, I don't want to. And then when I had the opportunity and I was like, until she gets right towards that very, that end moment, that's the cap essentially for this entire thing, for her arc and for Ralph Fiennes' chef's arc, I was like, okay, think I get it. And then I read that and I was like, oh, that's why it was bugging me.
So first off, started with, you read an article that said, because yeah. Secondly, I can see where the article was going with a lot of that.
It was an interview, thank you. It wasn't an article.
Because looking at it, it does make a little bit more sense in terms of viewing it from that perspective, because the Chad bros were hungry for a real life. They had all that money. Even they asked him, like, hey, how's so-and-so? And like, well, you know, it's whatever. Whatever, we got money. And it's like they were hungry for something real. The couple were hungry to be a family again, because she says, hey, I saw Perry the other day, blah, 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 blah. And the husband's like, oh, who cares? We don't talk about Perry, whatever. And the wife was very much like, well, you know, I want to talk about her and so forth. So you can tell that there was a hunger. I can see that. From this perspective, I think it works on multiple levels, yeah, to be quite
that's
frank.
Why I brought up the parfait joke.
Parfait. Okay, Shrek.
Donkey says that line, not Shrek.
I'm not calling you a donkey.
Not right now.
Do I really? We but I feel like that just speaks to kind of the genius of this movie and the writing for the film and the cinematography and the, you know, stage direction, if you will. Or set direction for the film, and how it plays out, because a lot of the things look very, the scenes building up to them, they look very simplified, but once you start getting into the moments of actually serving the food, or actually, like, that's when things instigate, that's when things kick off. It's like the catalyst, the clap that Ralph Fiennes does every time.
Spencer did at the beginning, and I was like, no!
It's like the catalyst for the event to occur. It's like the bell for when the boxing match is about to start. And mind you, it does work on multiple levels, to the degree that Amy read about in that article. Mm-hmm. To the degree... to the degree of, like, the different... what is it, the different shows that are out there, the different types of chefs that we've seen. We've talked about a few of them, whether if it's Gordon Ramsay, Julia Childs, Martha Stewart, Emeril Lagasse, you know, talking about people who have sold out in the food industry, such as like Bobby Flay or Mario Batali, or, you know, influencers of the industry who went with their, who were directed by their wallet, essentially. And you get a lot of that in this movie. You get a lot of that understanding, that kind of focus. I don't really know what fully, and I haven't read any articles, so I haven't cheated. But I was looking for
something different. I mean, we could also talk about the fact that this entire experience is held in a very sterile, rigid environment, which can also feed into the concept that, and no, I didn't read this, but the concept that the only way to have an experience worth having is in a sterile, processed, left, right, left, you can't divert, like, space. And what that does to the concept of enjoying or actually feeding yourself or enjoying a moment or an experience. If it has to be curated 100%, which we see with Tyler. Like when she gets on, they get on the boat and they get the amuse-bouche of the oyster with the foam and the little like lemon pearls. And he's like slapping her hand because he has to take a picture. And then when they eat it, she's like, oh, I guess I would have preferred the oyster. And he's like, oh, it's so genius. It's laughable. You don't know what you're saying. It's like, and yeah. I understood your gatekeeping, but also that there has to be a way to not only eat food, but to enjoy it.
Well, and I think what this film makes fun of most is when in companies like that, you can't just enjoy it because of the fact that there's always going to be a certain way or protocol that it should be prepared, eaten, digested, processed. Like there's probably multiple ways that it can, and there are people out there who say their way is the best way. And that gets in the way of the experience. I mean, we talk about it like with movies. We're not very like avant-garde. We're like, oh my gosh, did you see, you know, that black and white film from 15 years ago who all he did was a naked man in the middle of the room for like an hour and a half. It was breathtaking.
It sounds like an art house film.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, and I'm just like, oh, I don't want to see that.
But we're not, like I say, we give anything a fair shake here on this show. Now, if we were gatekeepish to movies, we would be like, oh, you watch, you know, you watch... whatever, you know, oh, you're just a horrible person, whatever. Like, people have their own preferences. We don't think highly of certain movies because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of intelligible value out of it. However, we're not going to knock you for going to go see it. That's your preference.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the nature of the game. People who gatekeep are those who say, well, if you do that, you're doing that wrong. You know, and we would never do that because everybody deserves to give their own opinion, their own thoughts. We even ask for it on this show. And that's different from like people like that, where if you go into a restaurant and you have, and it's funny, I used to be a very big stickler when it comes to steaks in how people view how it should be eaten, because I was taught the proper steak is cooked a certain way. After some time, especially after watching David Chang, he did an episode on Netflix called for a series called Ugly Delicious, where he did a steak episode, and he had a conversation about it with his friends, where he was talking about how, you know what, the whole idea where people are admonishing others because they don't have a medium rare steak but they have theirs medium or well done is preposterous to the whole idea of somebody creating something for the unique pleasure of someone else. If the way it's being created requires it to be this way, who's to say that's wrong? You know? And it took me a while to realize, you know what? Because I like making steaks. I like making steaks at home. I like making steaks over friends' houses.
You're very good at it too.
I try. And a lot of it is because I've watched a lot of TV. But I used to be a big stickler, but nowadays I'm like, yeah, you want to use A1, knock yourself out. You want it medium well, you want it well, you want it super raw, you want me to just open the package and put it on a plate? Like, I can do those things. However you choose to experience your meal or your, you know, your spiritual session, if you will, with your food is on you. And that's your choice. But it's one of those things where over time, I think we're inundated with certain protocols and certain ways of thinking that we're like, because it's the way our parents thought, or it's the way a teacher told us one time to think, or it's the way, you know, a mentor said, and we've held on to that, and not to the level of like of a gatekeeper who assumes however, but there are assumptions we sometimes make. I think this movie makes that idea and creates the satirical point of it that food is something that should be a passion for both the people eating and the people making. And when both sides lose that passion, then it's just another part of the machine. It's essentially dead to everybody. And I feel like that's part of the story that this one comes across, as well as the myriad of other levels, like Amy's parfait, you know. But I don't know. What do you think, Ames?
No, I like looking at it in that way and in talking about it, my brain kind of clicked and like you could also apply this to how we ingest art. Because we talk about mm-hmm. movies and we're talking about art in general. When you usually go to a museum, especially the older you get, the expectation of the museum is you go in and it's shh, everybody's quiet. You stand, you stare at the picture, you think, how does this make me feel? And if it doesn't make you feel anything, you're supposed to move on. Versus when children or children's museums let them experience art or science or all these other things, there is an inherent joy in the action and the reactions that happen when they're engaging with art, which is something that I know a lot of movie fans, regardless of what they watch, are seeking, which is something that this movie, much like that parfait, it keeps bringing up different, well, it brings up different levels and ways to look at it. And so I can't kind of tear away from that when I'm thinking about the end of the movie where we hit the climax in relation to the joy and innocence that I don't want to spoil the end.
Don't.
But that like tying that back into the innocence of a child or somebody having a passion, experiencing art, experiencing food, experiencing whatever. And the innocence that goes alongside with it, where it's almost like pure. Spencer. So I happened to notice something on the table. And it looks like you did some art too.
Yeah, I did an art thing.
You did an art thing?
Yeah. I went to the Van Gogh experience that was open.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How did that? What? I'm sorry. So the entire thing, I threw this really. We have been really
recording for about an hour. And she throws really? It like, by the way, Spencer, it looked like you did an art thing.
Sorry,
like,
what is my segue was what, do you think that he's about, now, about art and how he feels about experiencing art in relation to this movie.
What does that have? What? Oh my gosh. Okay. You're done. Okay, so
it was just a question on experiencing art and how the type of experience or Van Gogh thing that you went to, was it, did you find joy in it? Was it fun to ingest?
Was somebody trying to kill you? Like, you know,
there could be, I don't know.
Okay, I feel like I would have said something in the weeks about, hey, there was this crazy guy who was running around, he had his ear missing because it was Van Gogh, and he was killing me.
Wow.
I like that.
That's actually good. That's a really I like good that. One.
But, yeah, and I was trying to ask about ingesting art in relation to like you going to a museum versus this and how it relates to the menu, but I'm just not hitting anything. That once somebody just nope my brain
point A to point B did not quite go in a straight line.
I'm gonna take a nap.
Talking about this movie, and obviously like Amy said, we don't want to spoil the one of the better parts of the movie that really kind of culminate the essence of the movie into, you know, what the experience should be like, the full experience you should take away from it. So, but I do want to ask you guys is, were there any points of highlights or even issues with this movie that you guys had? Let's start with you, Spence.
I really don't think I have any like true issues of things that happened in this movie that weren't supposed to be an issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So let's just go with highlights, and without being like in a super spoilery area, I want to say that like a highlight for me is basically how Anya Taylor-Joy's character is, even though like she's in this with everyone else, she's also strategizing like in the back of her head, and you can just tell it throughout like the entire movie until it comes to a head and she's like it's go time, and she's just ready to like attempt something.
Yeah.
And like I don't know, I really appreciated that, because that kind of also got me like just like even the camera focusing on her, and like you can tell she's just like taking it in and thinking, like that like forced me as like an audience member to also take in what she's taking in and think about it too, because like this movie for me became like, okay, I am like, let's just flip and like put me in that. What am I doing to get out of this like whole nonsense scenario with this chef and his madhouse like cacophony of like food? And like I just really appreciated like how well like her acting made it easy for me to just slot myself into the movie
in her role particularly. Yeah. What about you, Ames? Any issues, any highlights outside of everything else you've stated?
I don't really have any issues. Yeah, like thinking about, like genuinely thinking about it, I don't really have any issues. It was balanced, and there was a lot of good beats to give space for breathing when you were just like, you don't know what was happening. But it also didn't deter from the tension that was consistently building in this, you know, in this menu slash game. Highlights, the performances were breathtaking, as long as with the food too. I wanted to eat. Except for the bread course, I think.
The bread course,
the
breadless bread course.
Yeah, everything else I would have just like dug in and started eating, but the breadless bread course I would have been like and the thing that I really did, it was odd. I love color. Like as I continue to explore film, I find out that I have a deep and abiding love and appreciation of directors and cinematographers that embrace color palettes and don't, like, I understand when they're using it to make a statement or they're setting tones. And in this, I wanted more. I guess it might be an issue. I guess I wanted more color. Like, I don't feel like it was as bombastic as it could have been for each of the plates.
But I feel like that's also
also on purpose. So that's where I was like, maybe it's an issue, but it's not really an issue because I really liked this film.
I bet you that was done on purpose, because, like, especially with, like, certain things that are set at the end of the movie, it kind of would fit perfectly to not make everything super colorful.
Yeah.
There you go. What about you, Eddie?
There were several enjoyable parts for the movie for me in this one. I really love there's a specific moment in the film when you start to hear what the chef's grievances are with everyone, and you come to find how some of them are actually kind of petty.
Oh,
and you're like, I'm sorry, why? Okay.
It was petty, but then there was like an undertone to the petty, and you're like, oh, but that's still really petty, bro.
It's petty, but he's the person in place of power right now. So petty to him equals death. And it's like, it was at that moment that you recognize nobody is perfect in this restaurant. From the very top with the chef all the way down to the lowliest low with Margot. Nobody's perfect. And it's at that point that the filmmakers make you aware that there is room for redemption, but it has to come from the top, because he is the skewed filter of morality, if you will, in this movie. Sorry. I really like that part. Feeding into the whole hunger scenario that Amy read about really does tie well. Now that I've kind of gathered that thought and understood it, it kind of ultimately makes the ending a lot more satisfying, you know. No pun intended if you've seen the movie. So it's there's so many different layers to it, and I enjoyed the movie. Like, this is a movie that I would definitely choose to buy, you know, and I've only said that about a few movies after seeing them, but this is one of those movies that was interesting enough that I would willingly pay to go see it again to gather more information about it, you know. But I do have a roundtable question for you guys.
Oh.
And this is kind of an easy softball one for you, if you have a couple of these in the chamber. But What are some of your favorite satirical works, whether if it's film, TV show, or stage? Because I know there's a ton of them out there. We've seen several of them from stage with the Book of Mormon, or, you know, film like with Tropic Thunder, or with TV shows like The Orville. These are all satires of certain genres or certain franchises that have existed for a good amount of time. And this is how people have chosen to express their either disdain for certain parts of it or express their way to honor it by making fun of it. Either way, do any of you guys have any favorite satires? And if not, how about I go first?
You go first, because I have, like, I'm kind of putting together, I thought of two off the top of my head, but they're one space, so I want to, like, give my brain a little more breathing room. Go.
And mind you, it can be either one of these. It doesn't have to be all three. But I really do love the satire with one of the films that I feel kind of pretty much projected how the world was going to be in the future, and that's Idiocracy.
Yeah.
I feel like Idiocracy was one of those movies where you watch and you're like, you know what? Gosh darn it, this might actually happen. Because the movie explains how the future gets to that point in time with the way people are nowadays. And it's hard to dispute the evidence, to be quite frank. And it's such a good movie, but it also gives us an idea of like how consumerism is such a big deal in this world that it essentially takes over everything, including the government. You know, it's got what plants crave.
Electrolyte. It's what plants crave.
And I feel like it's such a great example of just unique satire writing that not many people are still doing nowadays, mostly because probably it's not PC, which would make sense, but the idea of it is still sound. So, did you find one, Spence?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. do you want to share it with the class?
Yeah, I think I will go with The Truman Show.
Nice.
Yeah, that was about reality television really before I think it took off for most of the country. Well, at least for me, because I didn't have cable. So like that was kind of just like peering into like, you know, what if we just follow people around all the time? Well, one person in the movie. But yeah, that was interesting. And then like you flash forward like just a couple of years later, and then it's just all over the place of just like you're just watching people with their quote unquote lives on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Like with Big Brother or, you know, Survivor, all those shows that came out about it's yeah, it's definitely one of those ones. It's like, you know, this is the way the world is now. So, and people do it willingly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sad.
What about you, Amy?
Well, the first thing that I actually thought about was because you brought up musicals in Book of Mormon, I was like, oh, I know musicals that are satires. The first one that came to mind was actually The Producers.
Wasn't it a movie first?
It was a stage play first.
Oh, okay.
But the original movie that you're thinking of was Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel. Of course, it's done by Mel Brooks, who's almost his entire filmography is satirical in like Young Frankenstein, Robin Hood Men in Tights, Blazing Saddles, History of the World Part One, and it made me think of that. And then another one, which I'm not going to say is my favorite, but it was literally a satire of and brought about a big, I can't call it a renaissance, but Glee, as much as you hated it, when that dang show was on, everybody was like, oh my gosh.
Is that considered satire?
I thought it was.
I don't think it is. It's because it's essentially about a glee club.
Yeah, but it's also archetypes of kids that you all knew in high school when you were in like choir or glee.
Those
club.
Are just the character. I mean, that's literally, I would assume Glee is just a show about high school students, which in high school students, you have to have somebody representing someone.
That are absolutely ridiculously absurd.
I mean, if we're talking high school satires, I would think like not another teen movie.
Ooh.
You know, that feels like more satire.
Well, and the one that I like to poke fun at, even though it's not one of my favorite, is Enchanted. Amy Adams's Giselle is literally the cookie cutter Disney princess, and everything just goes wrong. And you're like, this is okay. I think I could do this.
Mm. Yeah. I feel like we've gone away from the more comedic type satires to more serious type satirical works. Like if you look in the past, like I mentioned, Not Another Teenage Movie, Scary Movie, we're looking at things like Tropic Thunder, Idiocracy. Nowadays, we have things like The Hunt. We have things like, what is that? Black Mirror. We got things that are like, that are more focused on the certain status of the world at this point in time. I don't know. I haven't seen a lot more, or maybe probably because they're not really, I guess, I don't know. They're not really as funny as they used to be. Maybe my humor's just matured. Who knows?
Possibly.
Because maybe like, your humor has just tanked and you've become more and more cynical.
Possibly.
Eh, who knows? What was that one with Seth Rogen and James Franco?
There's a lot of them. The Dictator.
Pineapple Express.
Not Pineapple Express. The one
Dictator.
Where. Dictator. Yeah. Is it called The Dictator?
The one where they go to North Korea to interview. The,
Randall Park.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
The Dictator.
That and one.
Got hacked.
I never got hacked. Yeah. There we go.
There's. And I think that might be just the way that people have started shifting instead of. Jojo Rabbit, could you consider the relationship between Jojo and his imaginary Hitler?
I think that that's a good example of satire, I guess, you know, because it's a satire of World War II during that time with, you know, in Germany. I think that's a good one, too.
Yeah, I think a lot of my exposure to satire would have been the Pythons, like with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or with... Meaning of Life, which is just a whole bunch of shorts. And after I had only gotten in like maybe 3 or 4 sketches, and I got to one and I just turned it off and I couldn't watch the rest. I've never seen the rest. And I read something where Eric Idle said the goal of that movie was to see how many buttons they could push before you turned off the movie. And I was like, well, you got me.
Yeah, there you go.
It opens with an entire song and dance about children and birth control in the Catholic Church. So, yeah.
What is that one?
Meaning of Life.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think that was the name of that movie, by the way.
Monty Python and the Meaning of Life?
No, the other one, the James Franco and...
The Dictator? It's not The Conversation. That's a...
The Interview.
The Interview.
Because The Dictator is that other one that...
Oh, that's Charlie Chaplin.
No, that's The Great Dictator.
I know, sorry.
The Dictator is that one with the guy who does the Borat movies.
Oh,
remember where he comes to America?
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes.
Who plays the Italian barber in Sweeney Todd.
So wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
I want to start with Spencer.
I want to start with you because as soon as you say everything you can, we'll know what we can say less. Left.
But then that means that I can say less when you guys say more. So this film passes for me, even though they're making me go first and I don't want to. This film is definitely an unexpected dip into a pool that most of us are vaguely familiar with the continued... glamorization and pushing of food-esque shows via streaming or what have you. The cast is absolutely brilliant. There are performances where you think they're going to irk you, and they turn out to be something really wonderful and spectacular.
That is actually really true, now that I think about it, yeah.
Yeah, because in any other situation... like, I know I wouldn't be as endearing to this film as I am. With all that being said, please make sure you're eating people. I don't care if it's pretentious and pretty or ugly.
I'm sorry. Yeah, make sure you're eating,
like
people.
You're eating people.
No, eating, comma, people.
Commas are very like, important.
Them commas is why I had to put it in.
Yeah,
make sure you're eating, comma, people. But make sure you are sustaining your body. Put in nutrients. I don't care if it's pretty or if it's ugly. Just do it. This is getting a 4 out of 5 monocles out of 5 for me.
Wow. Only 4.
4.5.
Oh, 4.5. Okay, okay.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. Commas.
You're struggling with grammar over there. So either the periods or the commas are going missing. So, Spencer.
Okay. So this movie passes for me. I think while I was watching it, I was like just slightly worried with that food critic going on that this movie was going to be very cerebral. So I was like really trying to focus on like what she was saying, what people were doing. And then it just turned out to be fine. So don't let that scare you when you first start this movie. But like this movie is like great. I kind of was like going into this and I was like, man, like this should be okay, I guess. But like I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought I would go, like when I was going into it. So I'm going to give this movie a 4 out of 5. It's really good.
There you go. This movie passes for me. The expectations that I had going into it and then what I actually experienced were two different things. And that's usually more on the side of a bad thing. However, in this element, it was actually a really great surprise. I really enjoyed every aspect of not only the main characters' story arcs, but even the minor characters and the ones. In actuality, every single character that's in it is a major character role because this whole room is in a vacuum of this island. So even to the characters or the actors and performers who played the chefs, other chefs, were all phenomenal. In terms of monocles, to something that Amy had mentioned earlier, I do have to admit there were performances in this movie that I thought were going to irk me, and I thought there were performances in here that I thought, oh, I'm going to like their character, i.e. Nicholas Holt. And Nicholas Holt did such a great job of convincing me to hate him that I have to applaud that. So in terms of monocles, I'm going to give this a 4.5 out of 5. Yeah, it definitely deserves it. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out at our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have over 300 episodes, allegedly. Everything ranging from action to comedy to romance to conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Check us out, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there, The Filmlosophers. You can give us a follow, give us a subscribe. If you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it. You can also check us out on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There we post as often as we can for all the great information on both Spencer's Big Scores and Jane on Scenes. You can check us out there, or you can find Jane on Scene where, Amy?
The only place it's ever lived, which is on Instagram at Jane Unseen.
That's right. Now, for all those who are in the Sacramento area, we are hosting a holiday trivia night at There and Back Cafe and Games. We'll be posting that on our socials this week, but if you haven't had a chance to check it out or haven't had a chance to sign up, get on that, because I believe seats are filling up and there is just a few reservations left. We'll be having a great night. We'll be having a meal planned for that. We'll also be having great drinks themed around the holidays, as well as some holiday trivia fun. There'll be prizes, there'll be goodies, there'll be community galore. So if you are in the Sacramento area and you're wanting to find a great place to have an opportunity to just share in your nerddom or geekdom, head on over to There and Back again. There and Back Cafe and Games, where we'll have the link on our Instagram page as well as Facebook page there. So, but like I said, this movie is still in theaters. If you haven't had the chance to go see it, please head on over to your local theaters. It is still playing right now, as I know of. The Menu, check it out. But again, as we stated, thank you for being with us tonight, and we hope to hear from you soon and tune in next week for another episode. So from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Cheeseburger Amy.
Class dismissed.